Hello and welcome to the Reverend Hunter Podcast. This is Tony Jones. I'm the Reverend Hunter, joined as always by the Watson to my Holmes, Brandon.
A Sherlock reference indeed. How you doing, Tony?
I'm guessing, Brandon, that you are a little more down with the Benedict Cumberbatch version of Sherlock Holmes.
You are 100% correct. Actually, I haven't watched the last season of it yet, but the first three, I believe, I watched were phenomenal. Really good stuff.
See, I'm guessing you are also the kind of guy who has a very strong opinion about the best Doctor Who.
I've never seen the show.
Oh, okay.
I know. Everybody assumes I have, but I have not seen the show.
That just seems like right up the nerd alley that you live in.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Anything BBC or anything like that, I'm totally into, except for that one. That's a little too weird for me, if you will.
Gotcha. I stopped watching the BBC when they took Benny Hill off.
So like,
that's a throwback reference that you won't even understand.
I get the Benny Hill bit. We've all heard the
Yeah, exactly. I grew up watching that on PBS late at night on Saturday nights. A lonely middle school boy watching.
That's different Benny Hill. For a middle school boy to be watching. I don't understand that humor. I don't get it. It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever.
Oh, well, how you been, buddy?
I've been well. How have you been?
Good. Yeah, I was up at the cabin for Labor Day. It was an absolutely gorgeous weekend. I mean, it was like, this is the time of year you want to live in Minnesota. No bugs. It was about 70 and sunny with a nice breeze. I went duck hunting a few times because it was early teal season, the first time Minnesota's ever had an early teal opener, and I shot one teal. We don't really have a part of the state where we have many teal.
Sure.
And I was hoping to shoot some Canada geese, but that didn't happen. I heard them flying around, but they never came onto our lake. But I have a chance to go Canada goose hunting this weekend, I'm hoping, with a new friend of mine who will have on the podcast this fall as well. So I'll leave that a little bit mysterious till we actually get a chance to hunt together and then get on the podcast to talk about it. So yeah, hunting season is kind of slowly rolling in.
Yeah. How do you prepare something like teal? Is it different than any other kind of duck, or is it just pretty much all in the same lines? Like, you know,
bread? Well, yeah, a duck, the duck really varies in its flavor. And like so many animals, you know, whatever they eat, that's what they taste like. So most people who hunt ducks favor ducks like mallards and teal. They eat things like wild rice. Wood ducks eat things like wild rice and acorns. Wood ducks are really, really tasty. Teal and mallards are tasty. When you get into the ducks that are divers and eat, you know, like stuff off the bottom of the lake, like they eat snails and other stuff they grub off the bottom of the lake, those are called divers, and those ducks taste much fishier and are a bit tougher to make palatable. So when I have ducks like that, same with when I have Canada geese, which, you know, eat a lot of like golf course grass and often don't taste so good as a result, that's when I'll make sausage, or I'll cure it and make pastrami, or I will grind it up with pork fat and make meatballs and stuff like that. So you kind of disguise the flavor of it a little bit.
It's just substance at a certain point then.
Yeah, it's just meat. So the teal, it was my son's 17th birthday on Saturday. I shot the teal that morning, so I cooked some bacon, and then I really just like I threw the breasts of the teal into the bacon grease and seared it on both sides. It was still cold in the middle, nice and rare, and served it to him for breakfast on his birthday with eggs, bacon, and teal breast. So and he loved it. Yeah,
that sounds like an amazing birthday breakfast, that's for sure. Really good.
Yeah, man,
it's fresh.
Yeah, well,
did you
that's as fresh as it gets.
Yeah. Did you do anything else this week besides the cabin? I know you went to the state fair. We talked about that last week. You didn't go again. You didn't go for round two or anything like that.
I did not. I know you spent last Wednesday at the fair recording. How'd it go for you?
It went very well. It was a lot of fun. We recorded at the Minnesota Bound cabin, and then I just ended up deciding to take the rest of the day off and staying at the fair with my partner. She had a ticket.
Awesome.
Everything like that. So yeah, we just kind of hung out at the fair. Ate some food, not a lot. Didn't go crazy this year, but yeah, it was really good.
And did people come and like kind of watch you guys record? Was it on the north side of the cabin where those Adirondack chairs are?
Yep, that's exactly that where it was. Yeah, we had about a dozen or so people stop by and just kind of check it out. It was a little bit of fun. It was nice to see some of the fans. And it's, for me, I watched Minnesota Bound as a kid. So it's kind of a surreal experience producing the show and then producing a live show and having people watch it. But it was really cool to see the people come up and talk to Laura and Bill about like just how much they've watched Minnesota Bound and how it's been a part of their life for like 20 years. It's kind of a cool thing to see.
Meanwhile, the sound of chainsaw competition in the background.
We avoided that. We recorded right in between the shows, and we had a guest. He didn't talk on it, but we watched Shug. Shug walked right in front of the cabin. Shug Emery.
No kidding.
Yeah. I don't think he was performing or anything like that. I think he was just.
You know what he does? Shug is the MC of the parade every day at 2 p.m.
Well, that makes perfect sense. We recorded just before too, so he was probably on his way to get to that.
Yeah, so he retired from the juggling act, but yeah, he still is the MC for the parade, and what a great guy, and still the most downloaded episode of the Reverend Hunter podcast, is that correct?
That is correct, and yeah, he's still releasing his YouTube videos, so if you're listening, check out his YouTube videos. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, Shug Emery, I should have him on again. Well, speaking of podcasts, the guest today on the Reverend Hunter is David Lemire. He is the host of the Wild Huntsman podcast. He has a voice made for radio, man. I mean, when you hear this, everybody, he's got the velvet tones of a serious podcaster, and he was kind enough to have me on. I think our podcasts launched around the same time. He was kind enough to have me on real early on his run. It's taken me another year to get him on the Reverend Hunter. But his podcast, The Wild Huntsman, is fantastic. You can find it in the link in the show notes. If you like the Reverend Hunter, you will like his podcast. He talks to people about the deeper issues of hunting. He talks to a lot of writers who've really reflected deeply on hunting and stuff like that. We talk about that a little bit in our conversation. He stays away from some of the stuff about gear reviews and the how-tos and the pragmatics of hunting, even though he's a very serious and accomplished hunter. That's not only not what his podcast's about, and that's not really what animates him. He's much more like me into the existential themes of hunting. So we have a great conversation. I think you will love it. I really appreciate you listening. And as always, would encourage you to subscribe, rate, review, like, and share the Reverend Hunter podcast. We do really appreciate it when you do that. Every review on Apple Podcasts helps, because it does spread the word, and it moves us up in the algorithm so that people who listen to other similar podcasts will get this one recommended to them. So we'd love it if you did that. Thank you for doing that, and mainly thank you for listening. And so here we go, my conversation with the host of The Wild Huntsman, David Lemire. Hey, David, the Wild Huntsman. Thanks for coming on the Reverend Hunter podcast, buddy.
Tony, it's such an honor. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
We'll see if it's an honor. Let's just see how it goes.
We'll see how it goes. See if you drag me across the coals here.
So why can't we talk about your job? I know we can't. I'm not asking you to talk about it, but I'm asking you why we can't.
Sure, it sounds a lot more interesting than it actually is. But my agency that I work for, I spoke with the ethics department before starting a podcast and said, how can I do this ethically without, you know,
So we can already narrow it down that you work somewhere that has an ethics department, because most of us do not work at places that have ethics departments.
Yeah, demonstrably, right? Yeah. No, I work, I've had 20 plus years of conservation law enforcement, Tony. And I think the only danger is the idea that if people are listening to me, the only ethical conundrum is that I don't speak for my agency. And
oh, right. Yeah.
That my opinions are not their policy. So, or not the policy of the agency. So it's, again, not as interesting as it sounds when you say I can't speak about my job. It's a pretty routine job and a pretty routine thing I do, but you know, I've been happy with it and blessed to do it. And, you know, happy to not talk about it if they'd prefer.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I'm just starting a job as a pastor on a church staff, which I haven't done since 2003. And I have been thinking about things like, I'm not a big like political yard sign guy, but I remember back when I was a pastor, the last time I made a deliberate choice not to, of course I could never endorse a candidate from the pulpit because it's actually illegal to do that. You could lose the nonprofit status of the church, but I didn't even put a lot, you know, yard signs out for candidates. Yeah. I feel, you know, I was in my late 20s, early 30s at the time. And now that I'm in my 50s, I'm kind of like, I'm sure that people in the church I'm going to serve know that I have opinions.
Yeah.
You know, and know that I lean one direction politically. Obviously, social media has changed all that. Are you the same on social media? Like, do you stay off of social or do you not? I mean, your Instagram feed is fascinating because it's mainly vintage pictures.
Yeah.
And I don't even know. I want to get into that and find out even where you do that. But are you on other, in your role, do you stay off of Facebook and Twitter and not, you know, rant about politics?
Yeah, I definitely avoid that. And it's, it's not so much professional or it's not strategic, Tony, so much as it makes me feel sick. Engaging with these people, a little queasy, engaging with folks via social media where we don't know each other, can't have that human connection, and just how petty and dismissive and ugly we can be in that setting. So no, I don't do it. I recently started a Facebook account to track down an author that I want to talk to. On the podcast, I wanted to talk to Jim Fergus, and somebody said, he has a Facebook account, just find him there. And I signed up for Facebook. I was on it for a day and a half, and when I deleted it, it was like I was fleeing.
It was
a place I didn't want to be in, and I understand there's a lot of benefits to it, right? And people, connectivity between people, but I think I only engage social media in order to... keep the idea of the podcast fresh in people's minds. And I do that poorly. I'm not a good Instagrammer.
No, because you're not really promoting your brand. I mean, I think your Instagram feed is really fascinating because of the vintage photos you pick. But yeah, I mean, that's the, I would flee from Facebook in a heartbeat if I could, but I use it to let people know I've got a new podcast episode or I've got a book coming out or whatever, you know, and there's obviously a couple billion people on that platform. So,
yeah, and it works well. I know that when one of my guests or a listener put something up on Twitter about the podcast or on Facebook about the podcast, I know that my downloads reflect that. And so, it's an effective tool.
But it's a Faustian bargain too, you know? Okay. Tell me this. What have you learned again, without revealing what you do, you know, 20 years in conservation law enforcement, you must have learned a great deal about, has that, I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, that role that you have, that job you have, that must be part of the inspiration that led you to launch the Wild Huntsman podcast.
Yeah, maybe that's, I hadn't thought of it that way, Tony. I think that it's part of who I am is I became a law enforcement officer in the field of conservation law enforcement based on my passion for the outdoors, and in particular, okay, my passion for hunting. And this podcast comes about from that same, it's the same drive, because I don't just want to do it when I'm doing it. I'm, you know, I'm reading about it, I'm planning for it, I'm prepping for it, I'm doing something. So it was real lucky and beneficial to me to be able to work in the outdoors. I'm not sure I would have succeeded to this level had I stayed in the private sector working an office job wearing a tie. I tried that too.
Yeah, that didn't stick.
Oh, that was terrible. That was, I was having an existential crisis 3 months in. The fluorescent lights.
Yeah. That stuff will kill you. have you gotten cynical because in your law enforcement life? Because I was a police chaplain in my town for 10 years and spent a lot of hours. I was required to do 4 hours of ride along every month. And so I rode along with a lot of different cops, you know, and that's a tough job, man. And I ran into a lot of cops who were really cynical, tired, burned out. And it's also not a career that, unless you're advancing in it, and you know, you run into the men and women in law enforcement who they want to become a sergeant, then a lieutenant, then assistant chief, then chief, you know, like they're climbing the ladder, but that's not the majority. Like in any organization, the majority of people are kind of get to the level that they're at, and then they stay there for a long time. And those people struggled. I saw them struggling to maintain any kind of equanimity about the job without turning cynical. Yeah. And just being in law enforcement in general in our country right now must be a somewhat touchy thing.
Yeah, difficult times, right? And yes, you're correct. It's challenging to remain optimistic, positive, you know, in the job of law enforcement, dealing with the worst. Everyone that you deal with, it's the worst day that they've had, at least in a long time, and for the most part. But I think I went into it fairly grounded, I think, in faith. And I think I know I've dipped into cynicism and negativity based largely. There's a lot of challenges, as you say. And it's difficult. But I think that particularly in the, we mentioned I have a little over 20 years in now. And now as I'm getting towards the end of my career, coming up on mandatory retirement in the next 5 years, I've definitely come out on the other side of any cynicism or difficulties. And I think it's because, it's tough to be a cop and be a good dad, a good husband, a good neighbor. You know, it's tough to be a force for good or positivity and be the person that polices an area. So, there are challenges. I think I'm doing okay with them.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, after you retire, I'd love to have you back on and talk about, you know, tell us some crazy hair-raising stories, because I'm sure with 2 decades in, you've had some of those. Well, you know, do you ever play Hearts, the game of Hearts?
No.
The card game?
No.
I mean, it's a great game. It's a great game, but it's like you can't lead with a heart until somebody else breaks hearts or breaks the suit. So somebody else has to play a heart before you can lead your hand with a heart. And so you just said faith. So I feel like you opened, you allowed me now because you broke hearts. You allowed me to go ahead and ask you about that.
No, of course.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you know what I'm about because I've been on your podcast before. Tell me about your faith background and how, I mean, first of all, I'd love to hear generally where you live. You just mentioned being married and having kids. Like, what's your life situation? And then also, you know, talk about kind of your faith situation. Cause I take it by listening to your podcast, seeing the stuff you post a lot of times, which references stuff you're reading, which is a lot of the similar kind of stuff I read, but I'll be honest, neither you nor I are reading the books that you would guess that like Christian hunters are reading. You know what I'm saying about that?
No, yeah, of course. Of course. I don't think we are. I'm in upstate New York now, and this is, I don't know, maybe my fourth duty station, and it's great. And it's a wonderful place to be. And this is the first time I've been in an area where I felt like I'm going to be here for a few years and not move. Hmm. And this is the place that, you know, my wife took a job at the local college. She's a theater scholar, and she teaches right down the street, and the kids are, you know, in a nice school system. So it's wonderful. You know, you have all of those sort of benefits of stability that mean so much if you've had a life where you move around a little bit. And I'm not used to the suburbs. I never will be. I don't care about grass. I think it diminishes me as a human being every time I start my lawnmower and wave to my neighbor. But yeah, small price to pay, I think. My faith background. I was born and raised in Massachusetts in Quincy, and then Weymouth, Massachusetts, just south of Boston. And culturally Catholic, Roman Catholic upbringing in an area that was predominantly Catholic. And it was a good sort of start. It was a good grounding. A child's faith could be nurtured in that scenario. I came up after, you know, I spoke to you about my preference for, last time we talked, when you were a guest on my podcast, we talked about my preference for high mass, my discomfort with the fruits of the Second Vatican Council and the casually dressed nuns and acoustic guitars.
You want the
and
priest
such.
With his back to you talking in Latin.
I want Latin. I want his back to me. And listen, I don't think that's better. I just think that's where I worship effectively. I understand that there were a lot of positives that came. But for me, I want a priest in a dress swinging the purse on fire, the ball of incense. I want
I think it's called a chalice.
Yeah. What's it called?
It's not the crucible. Anyways, I shouldn't be spitballing it live on the air. Chasuble? Well,
I know that the old joke is when you see it and the incense coming in and being swung is the old joke is that's a nice dress, Father, but your purse is on fire. So that's as much as I know.
Oh my God. I have never heard that before. I love that so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. The chasuble is the dress. That's my bad.
Okay.
That's the dress.
Yeah. Yeah. And I grew up with that. I left the Roman Catholic Church, as so many folks do, and searched and saw it. And when I met my wife, she was the granddaughter of two pastors in the Nazarene Church. And so.
Okay. Yeah.
That led me to going into college. When I was going into college, I went to Eastern Nazarene College in Quincy and spent some time in but not of the, you know, the evangelical Christianity. Mm-hmm. And met a lot of great people there. And I don't know, Tony, if I'm just a classic American or if I'm a particularly difficult person, but I also didn't find a home there. Mm-hmm. I may have been spoiled with the drama and theater of, you know, the Catholic Church as a kid, but also the evangelical Christianity just wasn't appealing to me on a intellectual, spiritual level. So I continued on. I got a lot of good grounding in Christian tradition and history and philosophy at that school, and was really blessed in that way. And
okay.
They sort of, I was trained as a critical thinker there, and they really helped me hone that. And so mm-hmm. It was wonderful to go to school there. And my wife and I go to a non-denominational church now, and, you know, we split the baby. we're down the road at the big church where, you know, they play that Christian contemporary music.
Praise and worship music, baby. Yeah.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. Yeah. And that's good.
That's a lot. Yeah.
My background and my church background leads me to see value in penance. And I think sitting through that music is an act of penance. I smile, I'm supportive, and inside I'm just
dying,
cringing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's, I guess if you're a Catholic, maybe although, you know, the Vatican no longer teaches it, but you might still hang on to that idea of purgatory and that you're, you know, in a process of being shriven of your earthly sins and being prepared for eternity.
Yeah,
right.
It's a purifying fire of that real loud drum whatever that style of music is. I don't want to insult it. Whatever that is.
Yeah, it's not my favorite either.
Yeah, but so many folks are just really enjoying it, and I think it really aids in the worship of a particular group of folks. So, you know, for that alone, I'm happy to, you know, sit through it.
Well, just to close the loop, the burning purse is called a thurible.
A thurible. That sounds familiar. I'm sure I heard that.
You probably learned it in confirmation class or something like that way back in the day.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah. I made it through my confirmation.
Tell me about this, and then we can back up and talk about your youth as a outdoors boy, hunting and fishing. But tell me about this book, A Sportsman's Sketchbook, because it's not one I'm familiar with, but I know it had played a pivotal role in your understanding of the outdoors.
Sure. So I graduated college. I had the existential crisis that one can have graduating college, where I said to myself, dear God, I'm graduating college and I don't know anything. I haven't read any of the classics that you're supposed to read. I'm completely ignorant of much of the world, and I'm graduating college. And I didn't expect to have that feeling, right? That catches us by surprise when we do, but I did have that feeling. So as soon as I graduated, I printed off a copy of, you know, the 100 important books that you're supposed to read in the Western canon. Mm-hmm. And I decided to include the Russians, and I did that. And I spent that first summer starting with the Russians, and oh Lord, that was a heavy slog.
Oh boy.
Depressing, yeah. and heavy and dark. But Turgenev, Fathers and Sons was definitely eye-opening, but he had written a book, and depending on the translation, A Sportsman's Notebook, Sportsman's Sketchbook. It's, I read it and I saw what hunting literature could be, and that was that it was very little about the hunting. There was a descriptor of the hunting. I went to so-and-so's land to hunt. And this is in Tsarist Russia, 19th century Tsarist Russia. But then he would talk about the serfs and the people that he met. And it was a lot of character sketches more than anything else. And so I read the book. I thought, does anyone else know that this is a wonderful book? And it turns out that most of the world knew that. And I was discovering it, you know, 100 years after everyone else. But it was so impactful that it's credited with, in part, changing the mind of the Tsar on how to treat the serfs and on the freeing of the serfs in Tsarist Russia. So this book, that it's a light, easy read and has so many layers of depth to it and such humanity to it that it changed the course of world history. If you don't free the serfs, the revolution doesn't occur. If on down the line, the dominoes. So that changed my approach to how I looked at hunting literature and on what it could mean. And that, and then of course Faulkner after that changed my ideas on what hunting literature was. And I'd grown up reading the hunting magazines. I'd grown up reading whatever hunting book I could get, but never realized that there was something beyond the me and Joe or the simple enjoyment I was getting out of it, vicarious sort of hunting trip enjoyment.
What do you think it is about that literature of hunting? A book that profound being so rare, this is what I wonder. Because hunting is such a primordial part of who we are. And I know that only, 2 or 3% of Americans today hunt. But that wasn't the case 100 or 200 or 500 years ago. But there isn't a very rich literature of hunting. Have you considered why that might be? Do you have any ideas about that?
No, I haven't, Tony, but I have, I did notice, or that did open my eyes to more depth in some of our more simple writers. You know, that opened my eyes to seeing the importance in a Gordon McQuarrie and a Gene Hill, reading The Old Man and the Boy, Ruark, and seeing that this was deeper than that first surface reading was. So, yeah, I don't know why there's not more about it other than, I guess I just don't know. But that's an interesting question.
I recently read the novel Deliverance, and I had, of course, seen the film, you know, years ago. But a friend of mine said, have you ever read Deliverance? You should read it. It's got the best written hunting scenes I've ever read. And this is from a non-hunter. And I read it and it's now in my top five novels of all time list. You know, it's really an astounding, as good as the film is, that the book is 10 times better. But it's just interesting how rarely we find well-written hunting scenes in fiction, and we don't really see many in film either. And it's just it's something that I have been wondering about, especially because I've been doing quite a bit of writing of hunting scenes and trying to make them come to life. And one of the tricky things has been for me to write in such a way that non-hunters will appreciate what I'm saying, you know, how I'm telling this tale.
Yeah.
But it's pretty gruesome, obviously, because hunting involves a lot of blood and death and even, unfortunately, sometimes suffering of an animal. So anyway, I don't really have a question there other than, you know, you're well-read And I wonder if you've got any thoughts on what constitutes, you know, a well-written hunting scene or a well-written book that includes hunting.
Yeah, I don't know. Hemingway did it well and did it right sparsely with that style that changed literature for decades. Yeah. But Faulkner did it well in a completely, you know, stream of consciousness, almost poetic style. Mm-hmm. I know, Tony, when you said something that rings true for even non-hunters, it hit me that I can't explain to non-hunters the beauty of hunting. I just haven't been able to successfully do it. I can say the words and say what it means to me. But if I'm speaking to a hunter about that same thing, I know that we're speaking beyond the words, that if we've both experienced it and the beauty and the drama and the visceral nature and, like you said, that primal feeling. I haven't been able to. And if you're able to pull that off, Tony, I'm gonna look forward to that.
I mean, I just paid an editor to read it, and she got back to me with all sorts of notes. And one of her questions to me, honestly, David, was, who is this book for? Because in some ways it's a spiritual memoir, and the people, your potential readers are people who love spiritual memoir. On the other hand, it's for people who hunt and fish, because there's just a lot of, you know, well-written scenes of particularly of hunting. And of course, my response was, why can't I have them both? why can't I have both sets of readers? Yeah. Then I'd sell twice as many books. But it's tricky. It's very tricky.
Well, you say that, and I wonder if that's what makes Turgenev's work so enduring. And so, you know, you can pick up the most recent translation, read it, and no problem. There's no disconnect. As many books written, you know, 100 years ago, there'd be a big gulf between you and it. Yeah. It takes a little bit of stretching for you to approach that material. Not so with this book. And I wonder if it's because he doesn't talk that much about the hunting. It's just about the people and the characters.
I know that, you know, you're like me, you are a multi-species hunter, a generalist. At least at this point in my life, my favorite type of hunting, the type of hunting that I fantasize about, daydream about in the off season, prepare for, is pheasant hunting. I think for you, it's waterfowling is your kind of cornerstone hunting.
Yeah.
Our early Canada goose season opens tomorrow. We're recording, you and I are having this conversation on Friday, September 3rd, and tomorrow morning, I will be out trying to shoot a Canada goose or two.
In a field or in water?
I'm going to be in water this weekend and in a field next weekend.
All right, you're mixing it up.
Yeah, I'm not a big goose hunter. I don't have field decoys, and I definitely don't have, you know, a 5x8 trailer with 500 field decoys.
How do we get to this point where that's what we need?
David, it's crazy. I was listening to one of your podcasts recently where, you know, your guest was talking about how he grew up goose hunting with his dad, and they'd put out 5 or 10 handmade goose decoys, and now he goes out and puts out 1,000. And, you know, I've been duck hunting several times in North Dakota, and I'm a duck hunter, so I'm hunting over water, but I see these guys with these huge trailers, and they're full of thousands of Canada goose or snow goose decoys, plus the flags, plus the layout blinds, and it's really something that, you know, it would be a fascinating way to hunt. It'd be a massive type of investment. And I'm guessing those guys who do that kind of hunting hunt almost exclusively that stuff, because you couldn't be geared up for that kind of hunting and then, unless you're a guide, and then also do a bunch of other types of hunting, but or unless you're extremely wealthy and have no job. But back to so anyway, I'll put out my 6 goose decoys at a spot in our lake, where our lake cabin is, where I know that the geese tend to land and eat wild rice. And the thing about geese is, you know, unlike ducks, it's not like they fly at dawn and dusk and that's it. Like, you never, at least around here, you never know when they're going to come in. There's, you can't really pattern them.
Yeah, that's great.
So it just means I have to sit out there all day.
Of course. It's a good excuse to sit out there all day is
what
I'm
hearing.
That's true.
I got some cigars and my dog will be out there with me, so I'll be fine.
Yeah.
Tell me about waterfowling. What is it about duck and goose hunting that you love so much?
Yeah, I think that I've always been drawn to the water. When I was a kid, before I could hunt and, you know, grew up with a single mom, urban, suburban sort of upbringing, and no access to hunting, but there was always water. And I grew up near the coast, so there was always the ocean. I grew up with a lot of freshwater ponds and rivers around, so there was always that option. I've always been drawn to the water. So I think the simplest answer is that I'm mixing my love of marshes and swamps and dawn on a river with hunting. And beyond that, it's there's a magic to such a ridiculous, overblown event as a waterfowl migration. And that, it's just to participate in that is wonderful. So yes, I'll hunt the resident ducks and geese all day, but to be out there in a November and the migration working as I had hoped it would, or a December and that same thing. And it's amazing just to be a part of that migration and that. And of course, ducks and geese are good to eat and probably not what drew me to it originally, but certainly something I've come to appreciate later as table fare. And my son, who's 15, that generational change is that he thinks about how he's going to prepare the food for the family as we're preparing for the hunt. And he's all about that. So I'm learning from him. I'm teaching him the ins and outs of how to do the hunting, and he's telling me how to cook them. So
that's
good.
Awesome.
It's good.
Tell me about where you and he hunt. Bring us there. Bring us as listeners there, sitting in the blind with you.
Yeah, I'm just adjusting to this area. So I didn't grow up here. I didn't spend enough time here to get a sense of migration until these last 2 years. So I'm watching how the birds move and where they are around here. It's mostly Big Lake up way up north in the marshy bottoms of that Big Lake. It's a lot of cattail, a lot of slow moving water. You know, it's a warm water type of an area in that marsh area, and it's just verdant with, birds and wildlife. And it's amazing just to be in there. And, you know, we're going to go out in a 14-foot Radisson square stern canoe with a little outboard on it, and just have a wonderful, wonderful fall.
I've done a little bit of hunting like that up in Lake of the Woods in Ontario. So do you get up, you're up and out the door well before dawn and in your boat going by headlamps?
Exactly.
Through a marsh?
Yeah, exactly.
Have you got a dog in the boat with you?
I don't. I just had a lengthy discussion with a recent guest and buddy, that I have never been settled in an area enough to train a retriever.
Hmm.
So my thinking about the only thing worse than waterfowl hunting without a dog is waterfowling with a poorly trained dog. And I grew up mostly, not even grew up, as a young man, I got to hunt with some folks. There were a lot of Chesapeake Bay retrievers, a few labs, a few goldens,
yeah.
And rare was the steady dog that I hunted with back then. And that was,
yeah,
you know, 30 years ago. So I never had any interest in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So I do have a hunting dog, but she's a primitive dog breed, a West Siberian Laika, who I mostly hunt squirrel with.
Oh, okay.
And she trees them. No, I have a crazed dog running around the Adirondacks chasing every, she'll hunt almost anything, but, we break her every year from hunting deer. Obviously, that's bad.
Yeah.
And she has a wonderful time chasing squirrel. She's, you know, at this point I could say almost, routinely treeing bobcat, and she'll be chasing the ermine up here. And it's a great sort of, if you haven't been to the Adirondacks, it's 6 million acres in the park, 2 million of wilderness, and it's right up a sort of a butts, and the boreal shield comes down into the very top of it in just a little area. So it's this wonderful area to hunt where it's, you know, true northern wilderness hunting, and, you know, a day's drive from a lot of metropolitan areas. So it's great to have.
Yeah, I know what you're saying about dogs that are not steady. My last lab was so high strung around the hunt that, yeah, he really struggled in a duck blind. He was much more made for the upland hunt, the grouse hunt or whatever, the pheasant hunt, because he would just kind of shiver and whine in a blind.
Yeah.
So if we were in a big built blind on the edge of a lake or a slough or something, it was fine because you could hide him in there and whatever. But yeah, I struggled with him when it was just like, let's just duck down in some cattails here and wait for some ducks to come in, because he was so, so excited about the hunt. And my current dog is much more mellow. Like, he'll, tomorrow when we're goose hunting, he will just curl up at my feet and fall asleep. And when the gun goes off, then he'll be ready to go make a retrieve or whatever. But he's just a different dog, you know? So I do know what you're talking about having a, and especially if you're hunting out of a canoe, man, you do not want a jumpy dog.
No, no. I don't know. Those Radisson canoes are pretty stable. I don't know if you've seen them. Yeah. Okay. They're almost as wide as they are long. There is, this thing's a little over 36 inches of beam, and it's got the foam sponsons on the side.
Okay.
Tough to tip over.
Yeah, you know, I have looked at those before online, and that's good to hear, because inevitably, I mean, you run into this in your line of work, I'm sure, but I tell people a lot, I think duck hunting's more dangerous than pheasant hunting, because, you know, every time you tell somebody you pheasant hunt, a non-hunter, the first thing they talk about is Dick Cheney.
Of course.
Every time.
He made it tough on the upland bird hunters for a while.
Yeah, jackass. But anyway, he did.
Yep.
But really, it's, you know, when I read the outdoor news and follow the CO reports, it's a lot of duck hunters, man, who, you know, two guys stand up in a boat at the same time, one slips and shoots and kills his friend.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen so much in pheasant hunting, because you just tend to be more spread out and stuff like that, but not at such close quarters as a duck hunt.
Going out into the waters and, you know,
yeah,
traditionally duck boats are 16 foot or less. In my experience, there are definitely big ones, but, and particularly for sea duck, but going out into the water in cold, harsh, windy conditions is dangerous and needs to be taken seriously. So I have learned my lesson the hard way. I've swum a couple, what's the past? I've swum in my waders. And
is that right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
In waders?
Yeah, in the Northeast.
Those are turn into anchors pretty fast when you go in the water.
I'm here to tell you, Tony, if you don't panic, and if you wear a wader belt.
Okay.
So I've always worn a wader belt, but if you don't panic, so it's going to reach mutual buoyancy when it fills with water. It's not going to get heavier than the water. It's filling with water.
Right, right.
The problem is that, of course, the thermal shock of hitting the water takes your breath away. Mm-hmm. When you lose your breath, then you start to panic. And I was always just too stupid to panic the couple times I've swam. So
I don't know about too stupid, too experienced, probably just because you've been around it for a long time.
No, but I was just young. That was in my youth. Yeah. I flipped a canoe in a swamp, on a river, and might have been December. There was snow on the ground, and I definitely went hypothermic because when I dumped the canoe on a new sandbar, went over sideways. I couldn't afford another shotgun. My Mossberg 500 shotgun went to the bottom and it was a little over my head. So I had to dive for it. I didn't have to.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't have to. I thought it was a good idea to dive for it. And I did do that. And by the time I got back to the truck, I couldn't operate the key to open the door. I had to use two hands. It took me 10 minutes just to get in the truck.
Dang.
Yeah, so it's dangerous. It is dangerous. Mm.
Well, I do want to talk to you about your podcast, which I find fascinating because I think like mine, it's not your run-of-the-mill hunting podcast.
No.
Yours kind of takes the whole hunting conversation in a very different direction. And I'm just wondering, I've talked on this podcast before about the outdoors media landscape and that I don't really feel like I fit in it and I don't really like it. I don't really consume it myself, especially the TV shows. But I think a lot of the podcasts that come out of the big, those same big hunting outfits are very similar to the TV shows. And it's a lot of how-to. It's a lot of stories of how you shot the biggest buck you've ever shot. And then the next year you shot an even bigger buck.
Yeah, of course.
It's a lot of stories about stuff that normal guys like you and I couldn't ever do. Cause we don't have the money or the connections or whatever.
Sure.
My podcast is not about that. Neither is yours. So what was the inspiration for you to start it? And then what have you been learning along the way as you've been doing it? How has it evolved?
Sure. Thanks for the kind words. And it speaks to your character, Tony, that you don't fit into that landscape.
Thank you.
That's a pretty challenging landscape. I went to the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers Muster in the Mountains rendezvous a month or two ago. And someone was referring to one of the shows that fit into your description as, I stopped listening. It came across as real bro-y, And
I think I know exactly the podcast or whatever.
Sure. And I thought, okay.
It's the same place where you tell listeners to send all their complaints about your podcast.
Sometimes. That's my more cynical side.
That's my favorite line of your podcast, by the way. I the other day I laughed out loud at the gym when I was lifting and I was listening and you said, and tell me if you want to see, and if you have any complaints and don't think my podcast could be better, send them to themeateater.com.
I think that was awesome. Listen, That's a very popular podcast, and they're doing great. So, you know,
they're a bit bro-y.
They've been described as bro-y, and they're meeting a need or an appetite, I should say, not a need.
For sure.
So they're meeting an appetite, and that's fine. I'll never hit the numbers that they're hitting. I've recently been amusing my children with my podcast numbers in Latvia. When I'm number three in Latvia. I don't know if we need to. I don't know if we need to have a trip over there or what we need to do. But I made it up to number three, and you know, I'm sure no one there cares where they're doing in Latvia. They're doing just fine.
Yeah,
but yeah, I went down a rabbit hole, and I was thinking about hunting literature, as we talked about, and hunting stories. And I was explaining, I think maybe to my wife, I was explaining to someone that sharing the story of the hunt is an important part of the hunt. So telling people that you respect, admire, like to talk to, that are, in my case, going to be fellow hunters, about that hunt that you went on. And it doesn't have to be, I shot the biggest buck. It can be, you know, I nearly fell out of the tree stand and, you know, or, you know, whatever. I sipped my waders crossing this river and froze for the rest of the day. Whatever the reality is of that, it was important for me to share it. And then going down that rabbit hole, you mentioned the primal or primordial aspect of hunting. And right along with that, in our earliest art and in our formation of language as we evolved, it's hunting is there. And it's, we're sharing our ideas on what hunting means and, you know, what it means spiritually, what it means to get that food, what it means to see that beast and your buddy's great performance on that hunt and just how important that was. And I started getting a little bit melancholy that I wasn't going to ever get a chance to talk to any of these people who had affected me with their hunting stories. And these are people like I mentioned, Gordon McCory. He wrote The Stories of the Old Duck Hunters. Brilliant writer that people don't know about because he never wrote his novel. He wrote, he was probably the first full-time outdoor column writer for the Milwaukee Journal, I believe. Okay. And he would write for magazines. And he'd write for the Milwaukee Journal. And someone compiled at some point his stories about him and his father-in-law duck hunting, Stories of the Old Duck Hunters. It's beautiful. And I thought to myself, I'll never get to talk to him. I'll never get to talk to Gene Hill. Although, you know, Gene Hill purportedly only did it as a tax shelter to cover his buying shotguns. he worked as an ad man throughout his entire life. He never, I don't think, ever just went over to outdoor riding. But so he might not have wanted to talk to me anyways. But I started thinking of that and I thought, well, all right, I can talk to these people, but what I can through starting a podcast, it's easy, right? You and I did it. It's something you can do. But what would I talk to them about? And then it just, like you mentioned, I'm not that interested. I'll talk gear all day, Tony. If you want to, if you want to stop recording and we'll talk boots, I'm on for another couple hours. I can talk boots with you. I can talk rifles. I go down horrible rabbit holes of ballistics and all that stuff. I'll talk about all that stuff, but it's not the important stuff to me, right? It's frivolous, right? Because Gordon McCory didn't care about any of that stuff, and he did just fine. And, you know, there's a lot of predecessors to us who didn't hunt with the latest name brand, merino wool, latest camo pattern stuff that did just fine. They did great. Mm-hmm. And so I know it's not the important stuff. And so I tried to get to the important stuff without being self-important, without, look at me, I'm talking about the important stuff, but by talking to experts in their fields and insightful, interesting people about the parts of hunting that interest me. And it's worked out pretty good so far. I've been blessed. The guests that have been willing to come on are it astounds me. You know,
yeah.
Every time I get to talk to someone new, I'm like, this is wonderful. And I'm very grateful to them for taking their time to talk to me.
What themes have emerged as you've talked to these people, you know, who've used the podcast as an excuse to have great conversations with people? Are there themes that you've seen pop up in multiple guests that have given you more insight into the practice of hunting?
Maybe not the practice, but maybe the experience. Maybe what hunting is to us right now. And one of the aspects that seems to recur is community and relationship. And it can be within a family, someone talking about their father or their older brother or their uncle and what it meant to be invited to that first hunt, or to tell the story of that hunt when their father came to pick them up. They were sitting on the log all day and they shot a buck, a small buck, and how they were bursting to just see their father come through the woods so they could tell them that they shot the buck. It's that there's a relational aspect that particularly men, we have a hard time expressing feelings in a large sense, in a general sense. And we have a hard time expressing real love and enjoyment and descriptions of beauty, particularly my generation and older. Kids are better at it. This generation is much better at everything, at life, than we were. But it breaks down walls. If you can sit shoulder to shoulder in a duck blind with someone, you're going to experience beauty. You're going to talk about probably something more important than, you know, whatever the sports scores were, or, you know, the news of the day. You're going to experience something. And so community building and relationship, I would think, are the two themes that I didn't anticipate that seem to recur.
That's fantastic. Those are spiritual types of terms, you know, community and relationship. That's what, for instance, the Christian faith is supposed to be about, that kind of fellowship and connection with the divine and with other human beings. So I found that in hunting. I sometimes wonder if I'm the only one, but, you know, talking to people like you and some others reminds me that, no, there are other people who think a little more deeply about the kind of human enterprise of the hunt. So
yeah.
That's very cool. What do you have coming up before we go? Like what can listeners look forward to on your podcast in coming weeks?
Sure. The next guest, there'll be one will be dropping tomorrow. So before this one's released, that's just me talking about hunting season prep and a little bit, hopefully a little bit more. As we spoke about, I don't really care about gear or all that deeply or anything like that. So maybe a little bit deeper understanding of how I'm preparing for the hunting season. And I have Edgar Castillo is coming on. Just recorded with Edgar, and he'll be up next week. So it's
great.
He's a fascinating guy, outdoor writer, and guy I'm hopefully I'll be hunting with at the beginning of October here in Vermont.
Yeah, awesome. I'm going to be in Vermont in the early October at the Outdoor Writers Association of America conference at Jay's Peak.
All right. So, well, you just earned yourself an invitation, because that's where we're meeting.
Is that right?
Yeah, we're going to hunt grouse, and
oh,
and you know, grouse hunting in New England is a time-honored tradition in literature, yes, and in practice. So,
yeah, I went to college in New Hampshire, and I've kicked myself ever since for not grouse hunting when I was there. but I can now have a kid in New Hampshire and a kid in Vermont, both in college. So, going to OWAA at Jay's Peak was a good excuse to get out there and see them. And
yeah, absolutely. And if you have a day, I won't pressure you, but if you have a day at the end, we'll get you into the grouse woods out there.
That sounds fun. Well, thanks. Thanks, David. I really appreciate your time and appreciate your podcast and what you're all about. So
thank you, Tony. I love the podcast and I'm honored to be on.
Thanks. I'm glad you and I are singing from the same hymn book.
Absolutely.
As they say.
Absolutely. And we'll be shooting at the same grouse if you're smart.
Okay. Cool. That's good. All right. Thanks.